And when we can't tell truthful stories about ourselves, we are unable to tell the truth about others or see the suffering that we're causing.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Ravencast for September 29th, 2017. That's when I'm going to post this recording, but today is actually September 28th, and it happens to be International Podcast Day. How about that, Suzanne Ross?
Well, who knew?
Who knew? So Suzanne and I got together and we said, hey, it's International Podcast Day, so we better work on a podcast today. So that's what we're doing. So hi, Suzanne. How's it going today?
Very good. How's it going with you?
It's going great. I have always seen that, well, this is a podcast, but we also do a video cast. And so people who are watching the video, on Suzanne's right-hand shoulder, there are a bunch of, well, not on your shoulder, but above your shoulder on your bookshelf. There's trees, branches with...
There's my ravens.
There are your ravens. How about that?
Yeah. Yeah, we just saw them randomly. Keith and I were wandering through somewhere. Who remembers?
Uh-huh.
And we're like, I think we need that.
Yeah, it's pretty great. And one of the reasons that we want to get together and do a podcast today, not only because it's International Podcast Day, but also because we are about to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Raven Foundation.
Yes. And you have been with us from the very beginning.
From the very beginning. My son was born, my oldest son was born like about a month before we started Raven. So it's easy for me to keep track of how long we've been going and how long my son's been going.
Yes. He reminds you every day.
Yes. It's 10 years. So Suzanne, I just want to give everybody a little introduction to the Ravencast, and then we're going to talk about the Raven Foundation a little bit. And one of the things that we are going to be focusing on this year and in the years to come is the idea of truth. So many people say that truth is relative, or we live in a post-truth world. What else? There's fake news. So there's all this kind of assault on the idea of truth. So we're going to be talking about that. But before we get into truth, I just want to tell everybody that, hey, I'm Adam Erickson, and this is Suzanne Ross, and you are watching or listening to the Ravencast, which is part of the Raven Review, an online magazine where we write and talk about memetic theory and the rivalry, violence, and scapegoating that so often divides our communities. Our motto at the Raven Review is change your view, change the world. So if you like to hear new perspectives on religion, politics, pop culture, and current events, perspectives that seek to bridge divides and bring people together, then please come on over and subscribe to the Raven Review at ravenfoundation.org. So Suzanne, it's Raven's 10th anniversary.
Yes, it is. And I had been kind of wondering what we would do in terms of a celebration. We had a contest for undergraduates that we sponsored with Cover this year in the winter, which went very well. But I was wondering if we would do an event of some kind. But I wanted it to, you know, be tied in with our mission, which is, as you alluded to earlier, tying in with conversations that people are having and providing some unique perspective on those, some ways to think about the things that are captivating our attention that diffuse conflict rather than fuel it.
Yes.
So I was just wondering what an event would be about. And of course, since campaign for president, whenever that was, a year or two ago, post-truth and fake news and alternative facts that just keep coming up over and over and over again in conversations. And so that was in my mind. And then I saw spring that our very first Raven Award winner, Heidi Stillman. She's a ensemble member, founding member of Looking Glass Theater here in Chicago. And she got our first Raven Award for her stage adaptation of Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, which is if you know it, it's a monumental book. And so it was an incredible undertaking. And it's also a text that's very important to mimetic theory. So we gave her the Raven Award. And I saw then this spring that another one of her shows was being revived and restaged at Looking Glass this fall. And it's her adaptation of Charles Dickens' novel, Hard Times. And I thought, I really don't know what that novel's about. I'd never read it. But I thought, wouldn't it be fun just to get people together just to celebrate our 10th anniversary and to go to see Heidi's show and just, you know, have it be just a fun event. But of course, we can't do something where we're not learning as well, unfortunately. We have fun, but it's also we're learning too. And when I talked to Andrew McKenna about this, and he was our very first board member at Raven, he said, oh, Hard Times, that is an excellent text to talk about truth and mimetic theory and what mimetic theory has to offer to the conversation about truth. And I thought, well, there it is. We'll have a little workshop on Saturday, and we'll all go to talk about truth. And so we're calling it Hard Times for Truth, our workshop. And then we'll go together on Sunday to see the show. So this is happening in October 21st and 22nd here in Chicago. If you're lucky enough to live in the Chicago area, you can join us in person, but we are going to be live streaming the event, fingers crossed, and prayers to the gods of technology. But this will be our first ever podcast live stream of an event as well. So we are really looking forward to it.
We're going to be live streaming it on the Raven Foundation Facebook page. So go on over there and like that so that you can watch this conversation. And what is the date?
The date is October 21st. It's a Saturday, and it's in the afternoon. I think we're starting at 1 p.m. Central.
And what's going to be happening at this conference?
So I'm glad you asked, because we have some fabulous speakers lined up. So we've actually broken the afternoon up into two panels. So the first panel is called Hard Times for Truth, and it's going to feature Heidi Stillman and Andrew McKenna talking about the novel and her adaptation and the search for truth and what mimetic theory brings to that conversation. And then we're going to have a little break. And then the second panel is called Hot Times for Scandal. Because when truth is hard to find, scandal is on the rise. And so we have two very exciting speakers coming in. Vanessa Avery from what's her university?
She just switched to a new university, so I'm not sure. Yes, I should know this. Vanessa has been on the Ravencast in the past.
Yes.
We talked about Judaism and sacrifice, and specifically the book of Jonah. So she is fantastic and just went to a new university. Mm-hmm. Hey, you know what? I'll try to look it up while you keep talking. And then
and with Vanessa on that panel about scandal will be Stephen McKenna, who is from Catholic University in Washington, D.C., who studies political discourse and the media and has been writing and working about scandal from a point of view of mimetic theory and public discourse. And he is actually hosting at Catholic University in Washington next year's Colloquium on Violence and Religion, which is going to be called After Truth. And so the theme of his conference and ours link beautifully. And so we thought it would be a wonderful opportunity for folks to meet Stephen and get to hear a little bit about his approach to scandal and truth and sort of get up for next summer in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely. And I just saw that Vanessa is at Denison University. And
that's
also,
it.
If people are interested in learning more about Stephen McKenna, he's going to be our guest next week on the Ravencast. And Stephen, I think we're going to do it at 2 o'clock Eastern. That would be 1 o'clock Central, Chicago time. So, Stephen, as you said, what is his role at the university? What does he teach? Rhetoric and
he's political science and media. Yeah. There's some fancy names for
next week, Stephen and I are going to talk about rhetoric and politics and scapegoating and truth. And we're going to just continue this conversation about truth next week. So that will be a live Ravencast next week. And we'll put the link on Raven Review website, ravenfoundation.org. So you can join us then with your comments and questions. So that'll be awesome. Yeah. So join us then. What else is going to be happening at this conference?
Wine and cheese afterwards.
Would not be a Raven party without wine and cheese.
Without wine and cheese. There'll be plenty of time for questions and conversations. We really want to engage people in this subject. And all these speakers are just very dynamic and engaging speakers. So I think it's going to be I'm looking forward to it very much. So
that's awesome. So let's talk a little bit about truth. It's commonly held today that truth is relative, that everyone's perspective is equally valid, everyone's opinion is equally valid, and you can just make up whatever you want and valid. We've got people who say science, you know, if you're on one side of the political spectrum, you're like, oh, science is telling us all of these facts. And if you're on the other side of the political spectrum, it seems as if people are saying, science, what? That gets things wrong all the time. So why should we listen to science? So how do we navigate this idea that truth is relative, that science might tell us all the facts, or that science doesn't tell us any facts? How do we navigate all of this that has so much to do with our politics and the way that we relate to one another? I'm struggling with this, and I need you to answer. I need you to provide me all the answers, Suzanne. Give me the facts.
We're all struggling with it, and I think what we want to do is sort of marshal any kind of resources we can find to help us navigate it, as you say, because they're turbulent waters, really, when you're trying to figure things out. This idea that truth is relative has a nice pedigree, if you will, because it's an attempt to say that no one can control the narrative of a situation for other people. So when someone tries to say, this is my truth, this is how I see something, especially in situations where the person doing the talking has more power than the person who's not allowed to speak, you really have to have that corrective and say, other perspectives hold a piece of the truth as well. One person's viewpoint can't control the whole narrative. And so that's a legitimate point of view. The problem that we've run into, of course, in our culture is we've taken this to its almost farcical extreme, to the point where, because we're now giving equal validity to all perspectives, truth is impossible to find. Because if everyone is telling the truth, no one is telling the truth. I mean, it's impossible to put your foot down on solid ground anywhere. So the thing that mimetic theory brings to this is the understanding of the relatedness of everything that humans do and think. Right. So to say that truth is relative is actually to be hitting on a truth about human beings, that everything that we think and understand is in relation to everyone else around us, right? So that there's never this straight line between us and the thing we're trying to tell the truth about. There's always some mediating force, some other person who's influencing us or not, or directing our attention to something or not. Or there's a mediator who's being excluded from the conversation. And by not being excluded, by not being included, we only have partial access to the truth. That can sound very theoretical and abstract. And I think what we need to do is talk about it with Charles Dickens' help and get into some of the characters in the novel, because the characters have a story that allows us that illustrates some of these problems with trying to find the truth on our own.
Awesome. Let's get into the novel then.
Before we do that, I do just want to compliment Heidi Stillman on her adaptation of the novel. It's a long novel, and Dickens is a very verbose writer, shall we say. He's not shy on the number of words that he wants to throw at something. And Heidi has distilled this plot down to its essence in the most powerful way. And so I really do encourage you, if you can get to see the show at Looking Glass, do it. Just do it. It's worth it. But so I'm going to just talk about two of the main characters here. As you can spend as many words as Charles Dickens on just talking about the mimetic implications of his novel. We're not going to do that. So Mr. Gradgrind is a man who is very, very committed to the facts. So Heidi opens the play the way the novel opens, with Mr. Gradgrind introducing himself by saying, "I am Thomas Gradgrind, owner of this school." He runs a school for children. "I'm a man of fact and calculations, with a rule and a pair of scales and the multiplication table always in his pocket. Children, I am ready to weigh and measure any aspect of human nature. Facts alone are wanted in life. This is the principle on which I bring up my own children." So here we have in this character this commitment to facts as all, that's all you need to understand life, human relationships, to make life decisions. And he honestly believes, and Dickens says this over and over in the novel, that he's a man of good intentions, and that if he can raise his children and teach his students to rely on the facts alone, that he will help them make good life decisions and ease their suffering. So he's very much fully convinced of the rightness of his position and the goodness of it, that he's a good person doing good for the people around him. For the sake of our conversation, we'll focus on his daughter, Louisa, whose suffering is so extreme in the novel. She's made to marry a man who doesn't love her, and we're going to talk about him in a minute. Many years her senior. She does it because her father wants her to, because she thinks it's what she should do, because love is not part of the equation. You can't measure love. You can't quantify it. And so her father doesn't even think it's worth discussing. Mm-hmm. And so her suffering is brought about by Mr. Gradgrind's faith in his own position and the goodness and rightness position. And it blinds him to the truth of what's happening to his daughter. So when we say that truth is relational, what Gradgrind is allowing us to see is that his ability to grasp the truth of the situation depends on his ability to understand his relationship with his daughter. So he was blind to the suffering that he was causing his daughter. And that was the truth that he couldn't see. So the facts are one thing, but our relationships to one another determine whether we have access to the truth. So he was not able to tell the truth about himself, about his own goodness. He was hardly doing something good in that situation, and he couldn't see it. So he needed to learn to tell a more truthful story about himself, and in that would make possible his ability to ease his daughter's suffering.
So as you're talking, I'm just reminded of St. Paul, who talks about truth and also love. And he says, if you have all the truth, all the facts in the world, but you don't have love, you're just a clanging cymbal and a gong, and nobody can understand you. And so you need these truth and love together. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the reasons is because we often use truth as a weapon, right? In order to bat somebody over the head so that they'll come to see the truth. Right?
Right.
And this seems to be what Mr. Gradgrind is trying to do with his children, is to just force them to see the truth. And it just doesn't work that way. It's not how truth works.
No, because truth doesn't cause suffering. Mm. The only thing it might cause is when you realize that you've been lying and you didn't know it, but when you realize you had been causing suffering. So that kind of necessary self-reflection is important, that truth will always cause. But if you are living within a truthful narrative, your truth will be big enough to encompass all those different perspectives, and you'll be able to see the suffering, and you'll be able to hear it and respond to it without being defensive or reactionary or in denial, you know.
Yeah.
That Mr. Gradgrind, that's a clanging gong and cymbal, sounding cymbal, good way to talk about him. Yeah. And again, I want to emphasize what Dickens emphasizes. What Dickens emphasizes is that it's not because he's a bad person. He is a good person, but he's caught up in a false belief about his own goodness and his own completeness of his own narrative. So he can't tolerate other people's perspectives. And he doesn't, and becomes blind to the impact he's having. So I think it's important because we need to recognize this is a pattern we all fall into to varying degrees. And we all, you know, Mr. Gradgrind's addicted to this idea about the facts, but we all have things we're addicted to, ways of thinking and analyzing and looking at things that we think make us better than others. You know, make us smarter, make us have a better perspective, a more truthful perspective, where when we have that attitude, we must always be aware that any sense of a superiority over others is a good indication that we may be telling a less than truthful story about ourselves.
Yeah. So who's the other character that you wanted to
tell? Yes, the other character is Mr. Gradgrind's dear friend, Mr. Bounderby. Mm. And Mr. Bounderby is the a banker and the owner of the factory in town. So Dickens' novel, Hard Times, is set in the mid-1800s in a industrial town in England called Coketown. And it's distinguished by the incredible smog and pollution from the factory chimneys, the black soot and smoke that just hangs over the town. And Mr. Bounderby is a man who loves to trumpet his own success and his own accomplishments. And he sees himself as this self-made man. And the truth of the matter is that he just had a regular sort of middle-class upbringing, but he tells everybody that his mother abandoned him, he grew up in a gutter, he pulled himself up by his bootstraps, his success is all owes to his own strength of character and will. And he keeps people around him as object lessons, like to show how great he is in comparison to them, right? And he treats the people in his factory, the workers, the hands, they're called just impersonally, the hands, as object lessons to say, you know, they're just not as good as I am, or they would not be so cranky and whiny, and they'd accept their place in life. And, you know, he's in denial about the circumstances in which they're living. He says that the smoke is the healthiest thing in the world for the lungs. This is, he's telling a newcomer to town. He says, the mills where my workers are employed, it's the pleasantest work there is. It's the lightest work. They're the best paid. I couldn't improve the mills unless we put Turkish carpets on the floors, and I'm not going to do that. Yeah. So he's very much needs to keep people around in lower, baser positions than himself in order to feel good about himself. And so why does he do this? You know, is he just a bad guy? Is he a wicked man? Maybe. But he shares a belief that we all share. We're all Bounderby in this way. We all share with him this belief in our own autonomy and our own independence from others, that whatever we accomplish has been the result of our hard work and effort. And if other people can't quite accomplish what we can, well, they're lazy. They're not as, you know, they don't have as much strength of character as we do. The thing we're always whether we do it consciously or unconsciously, we're always comparing ourselves to others. And often, unfortunately, standing in judgment over other people to make ourselves feel better about our own positions. And this belief in autonomy is the thing that trips us up. Because instead of taking pleasure in having received, you know, an advantage or being grateful for any kind of help or service we get along the way, this sort of spirit of being a self-made person makes us deny that relationship. And so that puts us again in a false relationship with our own stories. And when we can't tell truthful stories about ourselves, we are unable to tell the truth about others or see the suffering that we're causing. Bounderby, just the people he keeps around him are his scapegoats. He can't see their suffering, and he in fact needs them to keep suffering in order to feel good. You see, it's unfortunately a perverse way of constructing your sense of goodness, always being in comparison against others.
And this, according to Rene Girard, is the truth of human relationships from the very beginning. It's, you know, we think that we now live in a post-truth world, but according to Girard, we've always lived in a post-truth world, right? So at the very beginning of human culture, Girard says that human culture was built on the scapegoat, the one that we murdered in order to give us enough social cohesion that we unite and build the first human communities. So, and we also have to tell a lie about our violence so that we don't feel bad about ourselves, that we can feel good about ourselves. So the victim is the bad guy who deserved it. And this is where we lost truth.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, when we, and you're right to bring up the issue of violence, because that is where we really get caught up in this, which you want to call post-truth narrative. Mm-hmm. Because for scapegoating violence to work, we have to believe in our own goodness and in the goodness of our violence against this person. So we have to believe in their guilt, that they get what they deserved. And those kinds of narratives, of course, permeate our culture when we talk about, and, you know, Dickens talks, the context for his books brings up our current context in which we against punished or in prison or in debt or, you know, anyone who's struggling at any level. We can easily construct narratives that says, well, if you were a better person like me, or you're just, you know, you reap what you sow, people. You know, and so that then puts our good position in such a wonderful light, you know. So what we're, the goodness that we live within is not an accident of birth or fate or good fortune or anything. We earned it, you know.
Right.
So those all kinds of justifications of being judgmental towards others, of savoring punishment against others, vengeance, justice that is vengeful, all those things come back to these false narratives about the scapegoating narratives.
So Dickens diagnoses this problem in Hard Times of our social relationships. Does he provide any hope?
Well, what's interesting is that I chose these two characters to talk about because one of them actually has a conversion experience and the other one doesn't. So they're both forced to see the suffering that they've caused. Hmm. And one of them allows himself to be changed by it and to repent forgiveness and try to repair the damage. And the other one just keeps going on. And I won't tell you which one because I want you to enjoy the play.
And
enjoy the book. Exactly. But you know, why one of them is transformed and the other is not, it's a mystery. And I think that we need to constantly be asking ourselves if we're being confronted with something that we're refusing to see, and what can we do to open our eyes. Again, it's, you know, the biblical story is of Pharaoh's heart being hardened, and are our hearts hardened in some way so that we're not able to receive a conversion experience and begin to tell more truthful stories. That's something only we individually can look at and examine for ourselves.
Yeah, it's interesting because Pharaoh's heart was broken only to become hardened and maybe even more and more hardened as his heart gets broken. The reverse happens with Saul and Paul. Saul gets his heart broken, right? But it gets softened after it breaks.
Yeah.
So those are two archetypes within the biblical narrative. And why? You don't really know. Yeah. So it's a mystery. So, yeah.
If someone can figure it out, boy, that would change the course of human history for the better. Because I used to think when I first got involved with mimetic theory that all you needed to do was show someone the suffering of their victims and it would change their hearts. And even René Girard writes that when he first got involved with understanding this dynamic, he too had that sort of romantic idea. All you have to do is show people their suffering that they're causing and they'll change. Sadly, there's something else, as some other ingredient that's needed we can't name yet.
Yeah, I mean, part of it, I imagine, is that when you dehumanize your victim so much that they are no longer human, you don't care about their suffering. But if you can begin to flip the switch and see their humanity, that might be a hopeful place to go to.
Yeah, and that reminds me of this other idea that I've had about this, that one obstacle to this is that our identity gets so wrapped up in the other person being wicked or wrong or invisible to us, that to let go of that way, that narrative, feels like a death, because we really, as we said earlier, the truth will cause you suffering. It will feel like a death. And unless there's a new way of constructing your sense of self right there on the horizon, unless you can grab a hold of a life raft or a life preserver or something that says, yeah, that wasn't great, what you were doing, but it's okay. Here's the way to repent of it all and make it all better. If those two things aren't happening at the same time, I think we're kind of lost. Now, when I think about these two characters, I think that's the difference between why one could change and one couldn't. Because a new way of being was offered to him right at the same time, and forgiveness was offered. They were both offered forgiveness, but forgiveness was offered, and he latched on right away to a new way of being, of having an identity that he could just substitute immediately.
Yeah, you have to replace one pattern of being with another.
You do.
Yeah. Wow, fascinating stuff. So everyone, thank you so much for watching or listening to this episode of The Ravencast about truth and post-truth and relative truth. Truth is relative to our relationships. So maybe instead of saying truth is relative, it's more accurate to say, as our friend Andrew McKenna says, truth is relational. Suzanne, let's remind everybody of when our party is.
Yes, October 21st, a Saturday, for the workshop, and October 20th, which will hopefully be live streamed. And then we're all going to the show on October 22nd to see Heidi's adaptation at Looking Glass Theater.
Awesome. If you are in Chicago, if you can make it to Chicago, come to the Raven Review website, and they can contact us and we can get them tickets.
Oh, for the show? Yes, on our event page, there's a link to the theater and where you can get tickets for the show.
Awesome. Fantastic. It's going to be a great time. And again, if you can't make it, just watch the live stream on the Facebook page. Fantastic. So you can stay up to date on the Ravencast by joining the Ravencast group page on Facebook. Once again, we're going to have Stephen McKenna next week to talk a little bit more about rhetoric and politics and truth. It's going to be a great conversation next Thursday at 2:00 Eastern. You can also like the Raven Foundation Facebook page. If you're watching on YouTube, please like this video. And if you are listening on iTunes or Stitcher, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. That'll help us get the message out. One more thing, go on over to the Raven Review at ravenfoundation.org and subscribe. That will make sure that you keep up to date on articles and interviews like this one. Until next time. Remember, friends, change your view, change the world. Bye-bye.